and it's a pleasure to be with you here at APHA. Thank you for coming to our session. What I'm going to do is try to cover a lot of territory in a very short period of time. I don't think they put seatbelts on the seats, but just figuratively strap yourself in as I take you through. No relations to disclose for the financial disclosure. As I take you through the public health framework for tobacco product regulation, the infrastructure and the foundation that surrounds the Center for Tobacco Products, both operationally from a management perspective and programmatically, and then I want to walk you through the center's strategic priorities, which we released earlier this year. I think you're all familiar with the public health framework, but as we know, in the entire 20th century, there were 100 million premature deaths from tobacco use worldwide, and the projection, the trajectory for the current century is 1 billion premature deaths from tobacco use worldwide. So this is an uphill battle against death and disease. But here at home, it's about preventing the preventable. Incredible progress since the first Surgeon General's report 50 years ago this year. But despite that progress, still 42 million adults who smoke. Tobacco use, principally the use of combustible tobacco products, is the leading cause of preventable death and disease in this country, claiming the lives of almost 500,000 Americans each year and 16 million more living with tobacco-related disease. And every single day, over 3,200 kids light up a cigarette for the first time. More than 700 become daily smokers. And we know from the previously secret internal industry documents that years ago the industry had labeled those kids as the replacement customers for the addicted adult smokers who died or quit each day. There has been comprehensive tobacco control underway federally at the state and local level for decades. But now we have the opportunity to add the tools of product regulation to what we call comprehensive tobacco control. Congress gave the agency and the center the authority to regulate tobacco products intended for human consumption. The original grant of authority covered cigarettes, cigarette tobacco, roll-your-own tobacco, and smokeless tobacco. I think everybody's familiar with the so-called deeming regulation, where we have the authority to expand our jurisdiction through rulemaking, and we proposed to do that this past April. We're in the middle of that rulemaking. To include other categories of products that meet the statutory definition of a tobacco product, which is basically anything that's made or derived from tobacco. And the proposed deeming reg, and I'll say a little bit more about this in a bit, includes e-cigarettes, cigars, and hookah. If we do our job well, then we will be able to use the tools of product regulation to reduce and prevent youth tobacco initiation, to encourage adults who use tobacco to quit, and to use these tools to reduce the harm and the addictive nature of tobacco products. And we'll be doing that using a very different kind of standard. I served at the agency in the Clinton administration when an investigation, assertion of jurisdiction, and rulemaking under the old safety and efficacy standard led to regulation until that was all shut down by the Supreme Court in 2000. 9 years later, when Congress put the agency back in the business of regulating tobacco products, it was under a public health standard, appropriate for the protection of the public health, which means that we have to take into account the impact on users and non-users, the impact of what's going on at the individual level, at the population level, in addition to understanding the product itself. It's about assessing the net population-level health impacts of tobacco products. And we've struggled with how to illustrate what this means. And this is crude, and this is not an exhaustive capturing of what we mean by net impact to the population, but this captures, I think, some of what we grapple with as regulators each and every day. We look at patterns of use, we look at the toxicity of the product, we look at what's going on with former smokers, we look at what's going on with teens, and the impacts can be positive, negative, or both. For patterns of use, smokers who are unable or unwilling to quit, are they going to completely switch from combustible products to non-combustible products? Or are they going to engage in dual use of these products and dual use for a very long period of time? For product toxicity, for the products that we are reviewing, the new products that we are reviewing, are they less toxic to the user or more toxic to the user? With former smokers, are we seeing relapse to new products, claims in the marketplace? Or are we managing to keep former smokers from relapsing? And with the at-risk teens, are more of them starting to use tobacco or not? It's complicated because we have to somehow account and assess all of that and then figure out the net of all of that. Because it's going to be a combination of positive impacts on public health at the population level and negative. What is the net? That's what our job is. And e-cigarettes is really the poster child for the need for regulation and how does one go about assessing net population level health impacts. All of the headlines that came out when the proposed deeming rule finally published in April were about e-cigarettes, but deeming is more than e-cigarettes. It's cigars, pipe tobacco, nicotine gels, hookah, certain dissolvable products that didn't already meet the statutory definition of a tobacco product. This is what we have proposed to deem to be within our regulatory reach. And the proposed deeming rule has a series of what we call automatic provisions and additional restrictions. When deeming goes final, the newly deemed products will be subject to prohibitions on adulteration and misbranding. They will be required to list ingredients, register, list their products. They'll be subject to the pre-market review process, whether it's substantial equivalence or pre-market tobacco applications. They will be subject to prohibitions on misleading descriptors and unproven modified risk tobacco claims, and they'll be subject to a statutory prohibition on free samples. In addition, we proposed to establish 18 as the minimum age of sale for the newly deemed products, to prohibit the sale in vending machines unless it's an adult-only establishment, and for e-cigarettes, we've proposed a nicotine addiction warning, and the specifics of that one warning are on the slide. I want to now switch to the center's strategic priorities and give you a little context in terms of the building of the center from literally from nothing. The fiscal year that just ended a little over a month ago was fiscal year 2014. When fiscal year 2010 started, the Center for Tobacco Products at FDA had 2 full-time employees and about 20 people temporarily on loan to the fledgling center from other parts of the agency. So 2 full-time employees at the beginning of fiscal year 2010. A center had to be built, and the center faced over 20 mandatory statutory deadlines that Congress had put into the law. The fiscal year that just ended, fiscal 14, we have grown to 551 employees, and we are still growing. There are building blocks, both operationally and programmatically, that are critical to how successful we will be down the road using the tools of product regulation to reduce the death and disease from tobacco use. Functions that stood up centers, as we call them, whether it's the Centers for Food, Drugs, Devices, Biologics at FDA, operations and functions that are taken for granted had to be built, whether it's HR, IT, acquisitions. We had to create the capability to do policy analysis and external communication. So this is part of the infrastructure that went into the creation of a center that previously didn't exist at a time when there literally were only 2 full-time employees at the beginning of fiscal year 2010. But more programmatically, there are foundational rules and guidances that will enable us to do our job going forward. Deeming is foundational, and we're in the middle of reviewing all the comments that came in on deeming, but deeming is foundational. Completing a rulemaking, which we did on user fees, to enable the center to continue to assess and collect user fees, kind of important to the operation of the center. Sorting through issues related to investigational tobacco products and issues related to testing and reporting and disclosure, in addition to the massive investment in regulatory science overseen by Dr. Ashley, critical to the infrastructure of the center. This past June, we released the center's strategic priorities. And here they are. I'm going to walk through each of them at a fairly high level, but to give you a sense of what they are and a progress report in some of the areas where we have things to report, starting with product standards. Product standards are the tool in the law to ban or restrict the allowable level of ingredients, compounds, constituents, what have you, in the finished product as delivered to the end user for products that we regulate. Many believe that this is the single most powerful tool in the statute. And we are advancing a strategy. I can't share details, but we are advancing a strategy to take advantage of this authority. And we are exploring potential product standards in the areas of addiction, toxicity, and appeal. The second strategic priority is what we call the need for a comprehensive FDA-wide nicotine regulatory policy. And again, e-cigarettes is the poster child for a lot of fundamental questions and fundamental issues that we need to be asking ourselves. And in this case, about nicotine. We know the role that nicotine plays in creating and sustaining addiction to tobacco products at the front end of use. But that kid who experiments with cigarettes at the age of 12, 13, 14, 15, and we know that 90% of all adult smokers started smoking before the age of 18, and half of them became addicted before the age of 18. And so that group who go on to smoke, and we know that cigarettes, when used as intended, will kill half of all long-term users prematurely, on average 12, 13, 14 years earlier than a non-smoker. But at the end of life, it's not the nicotine that kills them. The nicotine created and sustained the addiction at the front end, but the cancer, lung disease, and heart disease that they experience later in life is from the other toxins in tobacco and tobacco smoke. It's not the nicotine. The very same compound has been regulated by FDA as a safe and effective medication for 35 years. And for almost the last 20 years, the agency views medicinal nicotine as so safe and effective that for gum patch and lozenge forms, it doesn't even require a prescription. So the challenge with e-cigarettes just being an example of what we need to be looking at, the challenge is it's not the drug, it's the delivery mechanism. When nicotine is attached to smoke particles and sucked into the lungs, that's a toxic form of nicotine delivery. When nicotine is embedded in medicinal gum patch and lozenge, it's viewed as safe and effective. So we as an agency have to look at nicotine differently. And this means that we have to come up with an agency-wide policy that's based on principles of public health. And this will have implications for regulation of tobacco products, drugs, and devices to the degree that we're talking about nicotine-delivering products. There's a continuum. There's a continuum of nicotine-delivering products that pose varying levels of risk. And there's a reality, first coined by Michael Russell in the UK over 40 years ago, that people smoke for the nicotine but die from the tar. So this continuum that I'm illustrating here, and this is just for currently regulated products, this is about looking at this as a public health opportunity to move people down that continuum, away from the most deadly, toxic, and harmful form of nicotine delivery to cleaner and safer and less risky forms of nicotine delivery. How could this be manifested in policy at FDA? Well, for us, it starts with finalizing deeming. And we received over 135,000 comments to the docket, which we are currently reviewing. It means articulating a jurisdiction policy, which we are working on and will be eventually shared with the public, so that you all can see how we are looking at when is it a drug, when is it a tobacco product, and we will be publishing this policy. It means working with our colleagues at the other centers, the Centers for Drugs and the Centers for Devices, on taking a look at how to evolve regulatory policy for therapeutic nicotine products, whether it's devices, prescription drugs, or over-the-counter drugs. And back home at CTP, it's about exploring options for possibly having expedited pre-market review processes based upon principles of relative toxicity and risk. And we posed a series of questions about all of these issues in the preamble to the proposed deeming rule that we are reviewing. The third strategic priority, again, something that's bedrock for more stood-up centers, but we are still building as we speak, are the pre- and post-market controls through guidances, regulations, and product reviews. Historically, there was no regulatory gatekeeper that stood between product developers, claims, products and consumers. And with enactment of the statute, Congress has said, FDA, you are the regulatory gatekeeper standing between the companies and the consumer. What does that mean? Well, it means that we need to produce policy in the form of guidances and rules when it comes to product reviews so that industry can see what the rules of the road are. All interested parties who want to play in the regulatory process can see what the rules of the road are for investigational tobacco products, pre-market tobacco applications, substantial equivalence applications, requests for exemption from substantial equivalence, modified risk tobacco product. I'll say more about that in just a minute. Tobacco product manufacturing practices, which we are working on, and being able to publish and point to analytical test method validation, critical to using tools of regulatory science to regulate the products. Where are we with substantial equivalence? And this is data as of the end of October. There's been a total of 4,618 substantial equivalence submissions. They fall into two buckets. What we call the regular applications are for those that were submitted to the agency after March 22, 2011, so these are products not currently on the market. The so-called provisional applications, the roughly 3,600, are products that are on the market or we suspect are on the market because the way Congress wrote the law back in 2009, companies could continue to put new products on the market up until that magical cutoff date of March 22, 2011, as long as they filed an application with us by that date. We have basically completed the jurisdiction and administrative reviews for all the applications that are coming. The only ones that where we haven't completed this first step are for the most recent applications that have come in. And for the regulars, we have resolved 45% of them one way or the other, either with a thumbs up, a thumbs down, a refuse to accept, or the companies have withdrawn the applications. And with this progress, there is now no backlog. Anytime a new regular application comes in, review commences immediately. And we've made enough progress in the area of reviewing the regular applications that in response to recommendations from GAO, we announced, and for the fiscal year that just started, we will be holding ourselves to performance measures for how long it takes to either make a decision on an SC application or send a definitive letter back to the sponsor, here's what we need to be able to make a final decision on your application. Provisionals, that much larger group of products currently on the market, the reviews have begun, and we have established a tiering process based upon the likelihood that the product is either more likely or less likely to raise different questions of public health, which is the key statutory notion in making a substantial equivalence determination. MRTP, modified risk tobacco products. Here's the schematic for the process. Typically, starts with conversations that take place between a company and the center. And if the company files an application, we commence the acceptance review process, which is phase one. In phase two, we either accept an application for full scientific review or we reject it. And if it's accepted for filing, and I think everyone knows that we have finally accepted one for filing, and I'll describe that in just a second, we then move on to phase three, where we take public comment, we commence the scientific review, we schedule a meeting of our advisory committee, and that's all with an eye towards taking final action. If an MRTP claim is authorized, then there will be post-marketing surveillance, and then the whole process feeds back, because MRTP claims can only be approved on a time-limited basis. And if a company wants to continue to make the claim, they have to come back with information and go through a reapplication and renewal process. So the very first application to be accepted for the full-fledged review was accepted this past August. We're in the middle of a 180-day comment period. We'll be taking this to TPSAC, over time, we have published a series of guidances for everyone to see what we're looking for in an application and how we expect this all to work. Fourth strategic priority, again, bedrock for a regulatory agency, and we had to build this out of whole cloth at CTP, is compliance and enforcement. We inspect, we investigate, we monitor, and we review. And in order to take enforcement actions, we have to build up the evidence case. That's an important part of what our Office of Compliance and Enforcement does. Along the way, we have built and we're expanding our state inspection program. We are planning for what the implications for compliance and enforcement will be when deeming goes final. And we have been working very hard on the complicated and sensitive issue of how to do compliance and enforcement on tribal lands. Here's the data as of the first of the month. We've conducted over 356,000 retailer inspections in 54 states and territories. We will be in all 58 states and territories this year. We've issued over 20,300 warning letters. Over 2,100 civil money penalty actions have been commenced, and those are actions against retailers that repeatedly illegally sold to minors. And just in the last few months, we awarded the first ever contracts to tribal governments to go on to tribal lands to conduct retail inspections within those jurisdictions. The final strategic priority is public education. Our focus is on at-risk, vulnerable 12 to 17-year-olds. There's roughly 25 million 12 to 17-year-olds in the country, and through our research, we've identified 40%, or about 10 million of them, who we say are at risk. And by at risk, we mean they've started to experiment, but they have not yet become regular smokers. Or, based upon our understanding of who they are, they may not have even taken that first puff yet, but they're literally one party away from that first puff. So we launched what we call a general market campaign called The Real Cost in March of this year. And we are working on companion campaigns aimed at particularly vulnerable subgroups. And in the years to come, there will be separate campaigns aimed at multicultural youth, rural youth. The rural campaign will be aimed at boys at risk of taking up smokeless tobacco, a campaign aimed at American Indian, Alaska Native youth, and a campaign aimed at LGBT youth. This is multimedia. So it's TV, it's radio, it's web, it's social media. It's very, very interactive. And we started with ads and messaging aimed at communicating health consequences in ways that will break through to our target, and addiction, but not using the word addiction and not talking about nicotine, but framing addiction in terms of loss of control. And we've had ads running, and if we've bought our media correctly, very few of you have seen our ads. There is some spillover, especially if you watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine. But in general, just by looking at the age of the shining faces in the room, you probably haven't seen our ads, or if you have, you've probably only seen them once or twice, unless you're old enough to have teenagers in the house that you're watching programming with. What I want to do now, and I hope this works, because when we tested this, being able to see the first ad wasn't that great with the light in the room, but we've just launched two brand new ads, and I want to show you these two ads. The first one we call the 7,000. There are 7,000 chemicals in cigarette smoke. This is our first attempt to communicate what we call harmful and potentially harmful constituent information to these at-risk, vulnerable 12 to 17-year-olds. And we call it the 7,000 because it's about the 7,000 chemicals in smoke. I hope this works. Does anybody see any light switch?
There's one in the back corner over there.
Okay.
you smoke, there's a toxic mix of over 7,000 chemicals coming for you. That's the real cost.
Our second new ad is continuing to communicate on the theme of loss of control if you become addicted, but again, never mentioning the words like addiction and nicotine. We call this ad Contract.
I, Amanda Green, at the point in my life when I'm not a kid anymore, now that I finally have freedom to define who I am, I hereby agree to be bound to you, to let you decide how I spend my money, to let you set my boundaries, and to come running the instant you snap your fingers. With this contract, I relinquish part of my freedom to you.
There's a contract in every cigarette. When you light up, you sign up. Don't let tobacco control you.
Thank you. We are incredibly proud of the entire campaign, and these ads we think will be very impactful. The 7,000 started running in movie theaters last week, and will be running in movie theaters throughout the holiday season. That was the 60-second version that's in the movie theaters. There are shorter versions that will be running on TV. Thank you for that response. We're off to a great start with this campaign. It's very hard to convey ideas that ultimately are about changing behavior. We're not selling a product, a tangible product. So we're at the part of the campaign where we have the most control, and that is the dose. We are spending $115 million a year on this in at least the first 2 years. And so we have exceeded the goals for what we call reach and frequency. We've reached over 96% of the target that I described to you over 20 times each quarter since we launched. And we're doing great on websites and with social media. The statistics are there. But this is ultimately about changing attitudes and beliefs and behavior. And so we have a longitudinal evaluation underway. We did baseline before the ads ever started. We will know soon how we've done on awareness, which is sort of phase one of the evaluation. And next year and in the years to come, we'll see how we do compared to baseline, moving the needle on attitudes and beliefs and then ultimately behavior. We think it's an incredibly exciting opportunity. No country in the world has been given the authority that we have and the resources that we have to take the tools of product regulation and add on to the long-standing, tried-and-true, and effective policies and programs that we call comprehensive tobacco control. This is now, what can we do using the tools of product regulation to build on the phenomenal work that has been done over the decades in the name of tobacco control? We have an opportunity to maximize the impact of these authorities, and if we do our job right, then on top of the tremendous work that has been done on behalf of tobacco control at the federal, state, and local level for a very long time, product regulation will make its own contribution to reducing the death and disease toll from tobacco use. Thank you very much.